Irvan Abrahamian is a professor of history at the City University of New York and the author of The Coup, 1953, The CIA at the Roots of Modern U.S.-Iranian Relations. This is Irvan Abrahamian. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. Great. So I'm here with Irvan Abrahamian. Thank you, sir, for joining me today.
Thank you. Thank you for calling.
I wanted to talk to you in particular, given the recent events between the U.S. and Iran. But before we get to the present day, I was hoping we could get some historical context. So first off, in terms of the relationship between the U.S. and Iran, would the 1953 coup be an appropriate starting place?
I mean, that sets the stage and I think the background, but I don't think that's determining factor of the present day crisis. The present day crisis really started with President Trump pulling out of the nuclear agreement. So that, you could say, is basically what triggers off this present issue. In the historical context, of course, how Iranians perceive the United States is very much influenced by 1953. But that 53 doesn't really determine politics. So I'm a historian, but I don't want to exaggerate the importance of history. Because when I think political leaders come down to making decisions, they're quite pragmatic and cool-headed. They're not really molded by what had happened years ago. So you can see on both sides, when they wanted to negotiate and they had reasons to negotiate, they were quite willing to basically put aside both 53 and also from the American side, the hostage crisis. So that it wasn't like the two sides were in an iron cage, one in the iron cage of 53, the U.S. in the iron cage of the hostage crisis, that the two couldn't negotiate. So there were many times, especially even Reagan, you know, with his strong American foreign policy, he kept on telling people, other countries, not to deal with Iran, but he was quite happy to deal with Iran when it was served his interests. Similarly with Iran, Khomeini is describing Reagan, United States under Reagan, as a satanic power. Yet Khomeini was willing to negotiate with Reagan again because it was in his interest to do so at that time. So, Trump administration had wanted to continue the nuclear agreement, they could have easily basically played down the role of Iran's Revolutionary Guards in the Middle East, because actually in some ways those Revolutionary Guards were helping United States fight ISIS, so they were on the same side. So they could have used that to say, well, you know, Iran has done some bad things, but on the whole Iran is a positive force in the region because it's fighting against the ISIS.
So even if it is not necessarily relevant to the events of the past few weeks, I still, if it's possible, would like to dive in a little bit to what happened in that coup, if only because it is very rarely discussed in mainstream Western media. One of the things that gets brought up a lot, not just by the Trump administration, but by the Obama administration as well, was that there's a lot of vocal concern for the Iranian people and the fact that they're living under a theocracy, and we just want them to be free and living in a democratic country. My understanding, though, is that before 1953, Iran had a functioning democracy. Is that correct, or is that an exaggeration?
The word democracy is sort of very difficult. There are not many democracies involved. So I would call it a parliamentary system, elected parliamentary system. And the prime minister, Mossadegh, was not only elected by parliament, but he was also, you could say, a charismatic figure who was very popular. Someone like Gandhi or Nkrumah or Mandela, he basically presented that side of Iran as a patriotic figurehead heading the nationalist movement against colonialism. So he was more than a prime minister, more than someone who had nationalized the oil company. He was, in fact, you could say, epitomized national aspirations like a Mandela in more contemporary period. Hello? We seem to have got frozen. I've lost you there.
Oh, can you hear me?
No, I lost you for a while, yes.
Okay. My apologies. What I was asking was the reasons for the coup, was it, as you mentioned, the nationalizing of oil under Mossadegh, was that the driving factor, or is that reductive to blame it purely on the basis of oil?
I mean, the argument, often the conventional argument, is it was about actually the Cold War and the fear of the Soviet Union and communism in Iran. And this was the reason given, the avowed reason given to the American public. If you look at the documents, especially documents that recently released in 2017, communism was not really a threat. In fact, the CIA evaluations of the communist movement in Iran stressed that it was not even a threat to worry about. I think the real reason for the coup was not specifically American desire for oil. That's a simplistic view. I think the real reason was the American oil companies and the State Department of Washington on the whole was convinced that if Iran succeeded in nationalizing its oil resources in 1951, this would trigger off a whole process and other countries would nationalize their oil. So countries that had American installations, American firms, such as Venezuela, Indonesia, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, those countries would all follow the example of Iran, nationalize their oil, and that would be a major blow to the United States. Now, of course, oil was nationalized eventually in the 1970s, but in 1951, it was really seen as, and as some oil company executives said, it would be the end of Western civilization as we know it if oil is nationalized. So that was, I think, the hard reason for U.S. involvement in the coup, because what the coup did, in fact, besides removing Mossadegh, it really denationalized the oil industry in Iran, gave it back to the oil companies, but in this case, with American oil companies as well as British and other European oil companies involved.
Did the American oil companies want to take this oil, or was this something that the U.S. government was more insisted on than the private companies?
They really did. They were not that interested in actually taking over the oil. What they were interested in was to prevent the successful nationalization of oil. The consortium that was created with the British, Dutch, American oil companies, actually technically that violated American monopoly laws, because here you would have American oil companies working together And that would violate the old anti-monopolistic laws that existed in the United States. What the State Department and what the actually the American government did was they promised the American oil companies that they wouldn't actually enforce that law if they came into the consortium and worked together inside Iran as basically different American companies, but working together, which technically actually violated the anti-monopolistic laws that existed.
Interesting. And after the coup, the Shah was in charge of Iran. What was he like? Was he just widely hated, or did he have any base of popular support in the country?
Well, he came to power basically without legitimacy. He had come to power by a foreign power that had overthrown a national popular leader. So he started really with a very sort of weak foundations. If he had tried to rule as a constitutional monarch, and Iran had basically a written constitution from 1906, he could have salvaged something and appeared as basically a figurehead overseeing the politics. On the contrary, what he did right from 53 after the coup, tried to successfully monopolize power. So other political figures, even figures that had been important and even important in the coup, were marginalized. So it became really a one-man power state. And here you often get a State Department document saying, well, you know, everything in Iran is fine, there's stability, the Shah has got the oil money, he's carrying out reforms, but they're constantly warning that the concentration of power in his hands is actually creating a very dangerous situation. And they said it becomes really a one-bullet state, because everything is now hinges on one man. And if something happens to him, the whole thing can unravel. Interestingly enough, in these State Department, CIA documents, they often say there's a lot of unpopularity in Iran, that, you know, there is a great deal of criticism and so on. But in trying to trace the why unpopularity, they can't go back to 53, because if they went back to 53, they would be actually criticizing the American government for having carried out the coup. So often 53 is completely dropped from the discourse. They will say, well, the Shah is unpopular because he's despotic, or he's corrupt, or people around him are corrupt, or he's spending too much money on military, not enough on social programs. But they can't really get to the heart of the matter, which is the 53 coup. And technically, actually, it would be very hard for someone in the State Department or the CIA to actually say, well, 53 is the core problem, because technically the U.S. had not participated in the 53 coup. So if you've read government documents and then you suddenly say, oh, the U.S. was involved in 53 coup, actually technically you would be violating the Espionage Act. You could be put in jail for 25 years for actually revealing government secrets, because the official line of the American government until 2000, the year 2000, was that the U.S. had no role in this 53 coup. So if you were an official and you contradicted that, you would be violating the Espionage Act.
Oh, wow. So they couldn't even begin to address the problem, because they couldn't address the fact that they might have caused it, or they did cause it.
Yeah.
Could you speak a little bit about the White Revolution that occurred under the Shah? What was that all about?
Well, that was actually on paper quite rational and a good idea. What it was that countries, it wasn't just Iran, it was usually pro-American countries where America was very influential, but the social structure was very feudal, i.e., a few wealthy landed families owned villages, who owned huge amounts of agricultural land. The idea was that if you broke up that large holdings and gave it to farmers, you would be creating basically a social base of millions of small farmers who would be thankful for having received the land and therefore would support the regime. This was done actually successfully by America in Japan. It was done successfully in South Korea. And it was thought if the same thing was done in Iran, this would stabilize the Shah's regime, that even though the Shah had come to power illegitimately in the coup, he would now be a revolutionary who was giving land to the peasants, and the peasants would be endeared to him, and everything would be fine. The problem was that they did start land reform, but they didn't carry it through. So they gave land, they distributed land, at least some of it, but then didn't follow it up with all the things you really needed: agricultural help, technical help, roads, water. And therefore, a lot of the farmers that got land didn't really become successful, you could say, smallholders. So on the whole, by the mid-70s, land reform was not considered a success. And a lot of farmers were dissatisfied.
One of the reasons I bring up the White Revolution is because my understanding is that Khomeini became the future supreme leader of Iran, and the leader of the 1979 revolution first started to run into trouble with the government around that time. What drove him into exile, and what brought him back?
Part of the land reform antagonized the senior clergy because it also threatened land that was owned by religious foundations. So there was an economic reason for senior clergy to dislike land reform. But also part of the White Revolution was extending the vote to women. And this was seen as undermining Islam. So there was basically some truth to the Shah's argument that the people opposed to him, to White Revolution, were reactionaries. He called them black reactionaries because clerics wore black clothes. But Khomeini, being actually a very Machiavellian politician, his issue with the Shah wasn't focused on land reform or women. He focused on a very nationalistic issue, that the Shah had given extra legal rights to American military advisors, that there were many military personnel, American military personnel in Iran, and they were no longer to be under Iranian law. So if they committed a crime or ran over someone, they would be judged by American law, not Iranian law. And this is something which often the Pentagon insisted when they have many advisors in another country. And this is actually relevant to what's happening in Iraq nowadays. Now, in Iran, this was a very sensitive issue because in the 19th century, the governments that had been weak had given capitulations to foreign countries, i.e. given special rights outside Iranian law to the French, the Russians, the British, and so on. And these were called capitulations. And they were seen as the ultimate, loss of honor, national honor, because you're actually giving other foreigners special extra legal rights within your own country. So Khomeini, when he actually challenged the Shah in 63-64, he basically took the issue of capitulations, that the Shah was giving these American personnel extra legal rights merely for $20 million that America was giving in military aid at that time. And this is when actually the Savak arrested Khomeini and deported him to Iraq. And from then on, he became now actually the new national figure in Iran, the person who was standing up for national rights, in this case, a question of the American military personnel. And this, like the 53 coup, this issue of the sensitive issue of capitulations was very important in Iran. It was completely forgotten abroad. People didn't know about it abroad. And it's constant, actually. It's not just in Iran, throughout the Middle East, this type of giving extra legal protection to American personnel is seen as a violation of national sovereignty. So in Iraq now, for instance, one reason there aren't large numbers of American troops, and they were asked to withdraw even under the Obama period, was because the religious Shia leaders there would have opposed presence of American troops, especially if they have their outside Iraqi legal jurisdiction. So I've lost your...
Sorry about that. I muted while you're talking so that my sound from my room doesn't show up on your speakers.
Okay. No, I can hear you.
Thank you. Okay, great. Based on what I'm hearing right now, it sounds a little bit like the Shah with the White Revolution had some policies that could potentially benefit ordinary Iranians, whereas Khomeini sort of took a piece of that platform and used it to drive a wedge between the population of Iran and the Shah. Is that fair to say? I mean, was this just a cynical political ploy? Or, I mean, why did it succeed so fantastically?
Well, it did resonate, because here he was saying, you know, here is oil money. The oil money is mostly going to corruption, going to the army. Very little is trickling down to social programs, education, the countryside. And you can't say it's basically pure cynical idea use, because after the revolution, in fact, the new Islamic Republic, there are a lot of things wrong with the Islamic Republic, but especially on the issue of women and veil and so on. But when it comes to social programs, they were actually quite good in readjusting priorities. So the defense budget, for instance, shrunk really from 17% of the GNP to about 5 or 6%, and the amount of money going to social programs, especially education, irrigation works, road building, construction of dams, drastically increased, so that in things such as illiteracy. Within 10 years, illiteracy was wiped out. You had a huge expansion of higher education after the revolution. And this was all basically oil money going into social welfare rather than military expenditures. So in that way, it is a big contrast between the two regimes on how money was spent.
One of the things that I've heard people say about the Middle East in general and Iran in particular is that once secular nationalism was made impossible by outside forces, the only outlet for people's desire for independence became this religious politics. Is that a fair characterization?
Especially if you look at in terms of organizations, because after 1953, the police and the regime systematically destroyed all nationalistic parties or socialist parties or communist parties. So all secular organizations were dismantled. They couldn't very well dismantle mosques. Basically, this part is like trying to, in America, close down all churches or something. It's not feasible. So the religious organizations remained there, especially the seminaries, the higher clerics and clerical organizations. So those organizations couldn't be dismantled. But there is also an intellectual shift. In the 1940s, 50s, people who wanted change, social change, tended to be either nationalistic or socialistic. In what you get in the 60s is, in part because there's a censorship of basically left ideas, there is a more of a vacuum intellectually. Clerics, religious intellectuals can write. And they argue basically a sort of a nativist argument that we should reject basically Western ideas and return to our roots. And the roots being predominantly either Islamic Shi or Iranian roots. So in this way, there is a shift in the intellectual climate away from, I would say, leftist nationalistic discourse to a much more nativistic discourse. And some of that nativist discourse actually became very Islamicist. I've lost you again.
When Khomeini came back in 1979, what was the buildup that allowed him to come back in and overthrow the Shah?
Well, this was after active months of street protests, which got bigger and bigger. So you have, millions of people out in the street. In fact, when he came back, it's estimated in Tehran there were over 3 million people out in the street to greet him. So it was, a phenomenon of mass protests. And one American political scientist has calculated that actually this revolution had more mass participation than any other revolutions. And revolutions, by definition, are mass movements. But here, actually, it was even more intense than other revolutions. But also part of the way the regime collapsed was not just street protests. By the end of 78, there were general strikes. The whole country was really on strike. So when some people talked about, well, the army should step in, kill some people in the street, arrest street demonstrators, and everything would go back to normal. This was an idea circulating in the White House before Khomeini's return. That could not have worked because the economy was actually completely at a standstill with the general strikes. How can a military, in fact, get massive people to go back to work when there is a general strike? So I think the Trump card eventually was this basically a nationwide stoppage of work and calling for the removal of the Shah.
So once the revolution has happened, I want to talk about two events. The first is the hostage crisis, and the second is the Iran-Iraq war. When it comes to the hostage crisis, what was the how did that come about? Was this a miscalculation on the part of Iran?
No, what it wasn't any thought out. The students, it was students who took over. They were convinced that the U.S. was going to do a repeat performance of the 53 coup. The 53 coup had been actually planned in the embassy. So they were right in that way. They weren't right in that U.S. in 78, 79 had no way of carrying out the coup. But there was this idea that U.S. is this omnipotent power. It had carried out a coup in 53. It will carry out another coup in 79. And there were people in Washington who did think in those terms. But again, they were unrealistic because the U.S. in 79 just did not have the infrastructure in Iran to carry out a coup. But the students who invaded the embassy were convinced that this was going to happen, and the only way to stop it was to carry out an invasion of the embassy. Now, once they invaded the embassy, there was such an outpouring of support, people in the street coming out in support of the hostage taking, that Khomeini realized this was basically a good thing to squeeze. He basically drew out the crisis in his own timing, and he used it to get his constitution through to a referendum. So you had two crises that are coinciding. One is the hostage crisis, which was an external crisis. The other was an internal crisis at that time, which was how is the constitution of the Islamic Republic going to be shaped? At the time of the revolution, there was a constitution. It was called an Islamic Republic, but it was modeled on the French secular Gaullist Republic, the Fifth Republic of France. The authors of that draft constitution had been in Paris, and they basically followed the example of the Gaullist French constitution. So it was very secular. It was called Islamic, but it was a presidential system like the French system. What the Khomeini and his disciples wanted was more than an Islamic constitution. They wanted a clerical Islamic constitution. So what they did was they revamped the earlier draft in a constituent assembly, made it a very complex, elaborate constitution, which was really had some markings of democracy, of elections. But overall, it was basically a clerical system where ultimate power resided with the clerics. Now, the danger for Khomeini was that if the government went to the public, and the prime minister at the time, Bazargan, who was more of a layman and also Islamic layman, he wanted a more of a secular constitution. If they went to the public with two drafts, let's say the pure Republican draft versus a clerical draft, the public would, in fact, vote for the Republican draft. To avoid that, Khomeini dragged out the crisis and created the mood that if you oppose me or oppose the regime, you're going to actually weaken the regime and open the way for an American invasion, because America was talking about dealing some tough way with getting the hostages out. So in that situation, even the prime minister, who had drafted the Republican Constitution, basically had to shut up and go along with the clerical constitution. So eventually, during the crisis, the hostage crisis, the regime presented their clerical constitution to the public and said, this is basically, you vote yes or no. And if you're voting no, then you're siding basically with United States and the foreign enemy. So that way, Khomeini used the hostage crisis to get through a very strong, you can say, rigid clerical constitution, something that he couldn't, it would have been very hard, if not impossible, without the hostage crisis.
Wow. So in other words, a lot of this had to do with domestic political concerns and nothing to do with the fact that he thought that there was a real chance of a coup happening at that time.
Yeah, I'm sure he at that time was not worried about a coup. Later on, he was worried about an American invasion possibly. But again, that was sort of a bit far-fetched. But he was using the public fears or paranoia as a way of getting what he wanted politically.
What about the Iran-Iraq war? How did that start?
It's actually goes back to earlier. In 1974-75, there was an uprising in the Kurdish areas against the Baghdad government. The Shah then actually sent a lot of aid to the Kurds, and even military of personnel to Iraq to undermine the Iraqi regime. And by end of 74, in fact, the Iraqi regime was really weakened by the Kurdish revolt. At that point, the Iraqi government came to the Shah and said, we'll make a deal. If you pull the rug out from under the Kurds, it's not, you've seen the Kurds have often been double-crossed, and this is another example. If you, the Shah, would draw aid from the Kurds, we will renegotiate the border between Iran and Iraq at the Gulf, where it's an area called the Shatl Arab, which is the waterway from the Tigris to the Persian Gulf. And in the past, the waterway was in fact, the border was done in such a way that it benefited Iraq. What Saddam Hussein offered Iran was that basically the border would be changed and Iran would get control of the waterway. So it was a major, you can say, territorial giveaway by the Iraqis to Iran. Saddam Hussein actually at that time was foreign minister. He wasn't the ruler of Iraq, but his name was labeled, stuck to that Shatl Arab deal. So you can say there was a desire by 79, 80, by Saddam Hussein to undo what had been done in 74, 75, which is giving away of the Shatl Arab to the Iranians. So what he saw happening in Iran is here you've had a revolution, overthrow of the regime, the army was more or less disbanded, country appeared like chaotic, that this would be an ideal time from his point of view to invade Iran, occupy crucial areas of the border, and then force Iran to come to the table and give back the territory of Shatl Arab. Okay, so you could say it was rational thinking there. What he miscalculated was that Iran, instead of coming to the table to give back Shatl Arab, basically said that no, we'll fight. There's no way we're going to give up territory we will fight until basically we defeat you. And that's what they did, you know, in the next year, within a year, in fact, they had forced the Iraqis out of Iran. So they had regained the border area. But the mistake Khomeini made was that he continued the war into Iraq. Instead of stopping there, he pursued the Iraqis into Iraqi territory. And after that, the war in Iran was not seen any longer as a defensive war protecting Iran, but was seen as something offensive, expansionist, and became actually quite unpopular inside the country.
And the U.S. supported Saddam in that war, correct?
Yes. In fact, most countries did, especially after Iran went across the border, including the Soviet Union, actually, became critical of Iran for continuing. One country that remained supportive of Iran was Syria. And that partly explains why the Iranian government still supports Assad in Syria.
And I'm not too familiar with Syria. Assad was not in power at that time.
Well, his father was, yes.
Okay, his father was, I see.
Yeah, it's the same regime, yeah.
Gotcha. So when you say that this was an unpopular war, and there have been other unpopular actions that the Iranian government has taken, like the execution of thousands of political prisoners in 1988, why is it that a wave of popular discontent swept the Shah out of office, but nothing so far seemed to shaken the Islamic Republic?
Well, you could say on an ideological level, this regime, even though it's unpopular among some sectors, has legitimacy. It came to power with a very popular revolution. And that legitimacy is still there. It's probably weakened over the years, but it began legitimate. The Shah's regime began illegitimately in 53. So there's a contrast there. Another thing is that this regime still, I think, has social support. It has people it can recruit, and people are still believe in it. The Revolutionary Guards basically replace the old military, and they tend to be recruited from the countryside, and especially from areas and families that have benefited from the oil money from after the revolution. And so there is, I think, still enough support for the regime to make it sustainable. It has, of course, and I mean, you've given examples, but there are other examples where it's done as salami tactics, its own base. It has basically become more exclusive. People who have, in any way, criticized the supreme leader or the regime have been marginalized, silenced, or even put in under house imprisonment. So the two important reformers who actually ran for the presidency are still in house imprisonment. So they weren't calling for the overthrow of the regime. They were just calling for reform of the regime. So the regime now, I think, could still open up and permit reformers have a say in the system rather than become narrower and more exclusive. And of course, the more exclusive it becomes, the more likely it's going to lose legitimacy and popular support and therefore become vulnerable to overthrow. But what could help it is basically an imminent foreign threat, and they could always use that in order to rally people around.
Let's get to the present day. Do you think that the Iran nuclear agreement was necessary? And do you think that it did a good job of achieving its aims?
Yes, actually, people who criticize the agreement haven't even read it. It's a very complex document, but it's actually, if you look at it, if we want Iran to be prevented from becoming a nuclear power in the near future, this was it. It basically gave Iran the right to enrich, but not to enrich in a way that it could become a weaponized nuclear power. And that way, it was actually over 2 years of negotiations. It wasn't just the U.S. or Iran, but 5+1, the Security Council, plus Germany were involved. And the main criticism of it was that, two main criticisms. One was that it had time limits. They said, 15 years. After that, Iran would become a nuclear weapon power. That's not true, actually. Some of the clauses go to 25 years. But even after 25 years, Iran would still be actually under the nuclear non-proliferation treaty, which existed before. So it doesn't give a carte blanche to Iran to build nuclear bombs after 25 years. The other criticism is that, this doesn't moderate Iran's behavior elsewhere. For instance, supporting the Assad regime in Syria. And of course, I think Obama's argument was these were separate issues. These are issues to be discussed separately. The nuclear issue was so important after you're dealing with serious matters, nuclear bombs. You have to deal with that as a priority. And other issues can actually come along later in the line. Israel and Trump then argued contrary-wise, that basically the nuclear issue was so bad because it gave Iran the roadmap for having a bomb, and therefore we should not have anything to do with it. That basically brings us to the present crisis.
Right. The agreement clearly has fallen apart, and I had heard you say this past summer that you believe that some sort of military confrontation with Iran is inevitable. Did I catch that right, or do you still believe that?
Yes, I think what is holding back Trump is that he doesn't want to go into a presidential electoral campaign talking about war. So if he's planning on war, he would keep that secret until after the presidential election. And why I think war is inevitable is he and Israel have made it clear that the nuclear program, nuclear deal, has to be completely basically eliminated. There's no way to continue that nuclear deal. What alternative do they give Iran is unconditional surrender. So you can see when Trump withdrew from the agreement, Pompeo came up with 12 demands of Iran. They said, we can now negotiate with Iran, but they have to meet 12 demands. The 12 demands are not possible to meet. They are unconditional surrender, which Iran is not going to accept. So what choice does Iran have? Their choice is, since they're getting nothing from the nuclear agreement because sanctions have been imposed, the economy is basically strangled. They have nothing to lose now if they withdraw completely from the agreement. And I suspect after the parliamentary elections in February in Iran, the hawks, or I would say the right-wing populists, are going to sweep the elections. The new government in Iran, the cabinet, will be much more tougher. And the first thing they'll do is basically say, well, there is no new nuclear agreement. Why should we abide with any of it? Ask the UN inspectors to leave and continue a rapid enrichment, in which case then the US would be, or Israel would be, left with the choice that they let Iran actually develop, well, they don't know what, or what they've promised to do before, which is militarily strike at Iran's nuclear bases. So at that point, I think if Trump is still president, he would love to take on Iran by attacking the country. So you would be then entering basically a new military confrontation.
For right now, though, Iran seemed to react to the assassination of Soleimani, at least compared to what we thought might happen. Iran seemed to react pretty mildly.
I lost you there.
Can you hear me?
No,
it's not on mute. Can you hear me?
Yeah, okay. Repeat the question, though.
No problem. So Iran seemed to react to the assassination of Soleimani, at least compared to what we thought might happen, fairly mildly. I mean, it did not provoke a war. What do you think is behind their political calculus here? Do you think they want to avoid a war more than the U.S. government does?
Yes, of course. I mean, the people still in charge in Iran are the moderates. Rouhani, Zarif, their cabinet is basically their colleagues. They're all wedded to the nuclear deal. They've been hoping that the Europeans will be able to persuade America basically to moderate. So they are the ones making decisions now. But after the parliamentary elections in February, you're going to have a very different makeup. Rouhani will still be nominal president, but he'll have to deal with a cabinet and ministers who are basically would be much more diehard, because Parliament will be much more diehard. And they're not going to be that eager to try to avoid confrontation. They will see what they could do. They will think much more in terms of basically tit for tat. You killed our general, we'll kill one of your generals. Their mentality would be much more like that than what happened with the present government, of basically giving a warning that they're going to fire some missiles at American base and make sure that no one gets injured. So that was done in a very careful way, not to raise the tempo.
You said you expect the right-wing populists to sweep the next elections. If I'm an ordinary Iranian, what does the news of Soleimani's assassination mean to me?
Well, first of all, there's a number of insults. One is that the American government categorizes the Iranian government as a terrorist organization. And then secondly, they act on it and brazenly kill a top figure of that government. That sort of ultimate insult. That's why in terms of the right-wing mentality, then the only way to counterbalance that is tit for tat. And Soleimani actually had got pretty good favorable coverage, because he was seen as the person who was able to defeat ISIS in Iraq. He was the one who was able to organize the militias abroad as a way of protecting the country. So for many nationalists, he was, in a way, a national hero. And I'm not sure how much the average person blames Soleimani for the repression the Revolutionary Guards have done inside the country, because his activities were outside. There are plenty of other generals that are responsible for dispersing demonstrations. I don't think he was ever really involved in those activities within the country. His sphere of activities was outside the country.
For people within Iran who do have legitimate complaints against their government, do you think they would want America to interfere on their behalf?
No, partly for nationalistic reasons about the history. But another reason I think they don't want American involvement is they can see what's happened in other countries where U.S. has got involved. So you have Iraq. Sure, Saddam Hussein was bad, but after Saddam Hussein, you really got complete anarchy, mass killings on a gigantic scale, never seen before in the Middle East, of slaughter, of, you know, sectarian slaughter. The rise of ISIS there. You had the intervention in Libya, and Libya doesn't exist anymore. It's basically turned into a Hobbesian situation of anarchy. Similarly, in Syria, there was massive foreign intervention in Syria, pouring of arms into Syria, and that resulted in the really destruction of Syria. So I think the average Iranian could see what's happened in the neighboring countries, and the last thing they want is similar. So they would prefer to have a somewhat oppressive regime rather than a Hobbesian situation.
And for those of us in the U.S., this will be my last question because we're getting at an hour here. I don't want to take up your entire day. But for those of us in the U.S., if we had a genuine desire for the people of Iran to be free, or at least more free than they are now, what could the U.S. government be doing besides assassinating Iranian generals and issuing sanctions?
Well, it's simple, but of course it's under the present administration, it's utopian, is to go back to the nuclear agreement and lift some of the sanctions. That would actually boost up the reformers in the country. And you could very well see the regime opening up if there is less pressure on it. And there are plenty of people in the regime who want normalization of relations with the West, especially with the United States. So it's not you're dealing with some country that is inherently has vital conflicts with the United States. It's much more a regime with a complex trends there. And the trends that want to support normalization could be actually encouraged to be more vocal and help to come to power.
Well, on that note, sir, thank you very much for your time. This was a very informative conversation.
Thank you, Duncan, for good questions. I hope I tried to answer them well.
Absolutely.
Thank you to Irvan Abrahamian, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.